Hey, Sustainable Asia listeners. We have a great new episode discussing the United Nations Global Plastics Treaty from the view of advocates here in Asia. Our guests today have been working for decades to reduce plastic pollution at its source. Just a brief tip, though, if you haven't tuned into previous episodes in this season, you might want to. It'll catch you up on where we're at with the plastic treaty negotiations. Well, the third meeting of the Global Plastics Treaty, otherwise called INC3, ended last November, and the revised zero draft of the treaty is out. But there wasn't a lot of progress during those INC3 meetings. So for this episode, we're partnering with Break Free from Plastic, or BFFP, to get their members' views as we gear up for the next treaty negotiations at INC4 in April. BFFP has more than 12,000 organizations and individuals around the world working together to demand reductions in single-use plastics and advocate for lasting solutions to the plastic pollution crisis. Today, I'm joined by three BFFP members. First, Arpita Bhagat, Plastic Policy Officer, Gaia Asia Pacific, based in India. Gaia is a network of more than 1,000 organizations from 92 countries whose vision is a just, zero-waste world free from the burden of toxic pollution, where resources are sustainably conserved but not burned or dumped. Next, Semi Ree, Global Policy Advisor with BFFP in Korea. Semi represents BFFP in the plastics treaty process. Finally, Mageswari Sangaralingam is the Honorary Secretary at Sahabat Alam Malaysia, based in Penang, and is a research officer with the Consumers Association of Penang for the past 32 years. She represented Sahabat Alam Malaysia, or Friends of the Earth Malaysia, at the recent INC3 Plastics Treaty meeting.
So welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you.
Hi, hello.
From around the world, right?
Very excited to be here.
Exactly. We've got India, Korea, and Malaysia. Love it. So, Mageswari, or Mages, hopefully I can call you that. Can you give us some color as to what was the result of the INC3 meetings in Nairobi last November?
Okay. Hello, Marcy. So before I speak about the results, I'll tell you what the aim of the INC3 meeting was. It was to advance the development of the international legally binding instrument using a zero draft as a basis for discussions. So the delegates had to address issues that have not been previously considered by the committee, including those related to the general provisions, for instance, scope and definition of the treaty. And they also used a synthesis report of submissions compiled by the secretariat earlier. And they were also to decide on a plan for intersessional work. So three contact groups were established at the INC3, and bulk of the meeting was spent with delegates proposing textual submissions to be included in a revised zero draft. Now let's talk about the results. So at the final hours of the INC, it went on till the final day was late night. The delegates were able to agree on a mandate for the preparation of a revised zero draft, based on the compilation of submissions by delegations throughout the week. So the revised draft included those elements contained in the synthesis report. But then, after the long discussions, however, the delegates were unable to agree on a mandate for intersessional work. This has to be done, on preparation of INC4. So between INC3 and INC4, at the meantime, There has not been any intersessional work to discuss the treaty.
Okay. And can you just describe why this intersessional work is so important? Maybe give some examples.
Yeah, so the intersessional work is important so that at least we can discuss before the INC4 some of the issues that has been raised in the zero draft. So this could be in terms of elimination of polymers and chemicals of concern. So some of the elements that was in the zero draft can be discussed during the intersessional work. Yeah, and also in terms probably the rules of procedure or means of implementation.
Right, exactly. So get some of the nitty-gritty out before you get to INC4. Is that kind of a way to think about it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then, Arpita, what was your view of INC3? How did you walk away? Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
Okay, so I'm going to try to be brief, but so INC3 was the midpoint of a five round of negotiating meetings, right? So we should have reached a point of having made at least halfway of the success in terms of the draft itself. But what actually happened is we got in with a 36-pager, if I'm not wrong, zero draft that was prepared by the secretariat before INC3 started. And the expectation was to kind of negotiate that draft. What actually happened was that member states, there was the first reading, as it's called, of the zero draft done through contact groups, as Magus has explained. But what we got away with is member states adding on to that particular text with alternatives, with deletions, with many opinions that included having some of the provisions removed, right? So right. At the end of INC3, I mean, what we have was secretariat kind of putting it all together without even streamlining the text. That was the request made. And we currently are sitting with a 68 to 70 page document, which is called the revised zero draft. And right. The last few months, I can speak for everyone here and across the movement, everyone has been trying to get their heads around this massive, ginormous document, a lot of which is actually not even legally meaningful text. Right. And this is also a result of how the negotiation was structured. This is also the result of so-called like-minded group of countries who were doing everything possible to kind of delay the process, delay the discussion, giving claims of our voices was not heard, which was clearly not the case. But I'll let Semi talk more about it.
Okay, your turn, Semi, because I do want to interject that, of course, so you've got this huge zero draft now, this long zero draft, and as Magus said, there were no meetings or discussions really to move forward the draft between INC and 3 and INC 4. Very frustrating, but I'd love to get your view of things.
Right, so as Magus and Arpita have said earlier, our goal going into INC3 was to make sure that all the options within the zero draft that we like and that we are advocating for were going to be remained in the zero draft, and all the other options that were either superfluous or rather insignificant in terms of really helping to end plastic pollution would somehow either not get support or somehow get deleted or fall out from the options that were presented in the zero draft. And as Arpita and Magus said, unfortunately, that did not happen. And what we ended up with was something more than what we wanted. Yeah. And so this current revised zero draft, some people even call it a sub-zero draft for that matter. Exactly. It's quite a difficult document for many country delegates to work with, mainly because if you do a close reading of the options that are contained within this revised zero draft, you would see that some options are rather kind of raise some questions as you're reading. Some options are actually even contradictory within right. the options that are proposed. And so this very, it's really hard to wrap your head around as to how we are going to use this as a basis of any textual negotiation going forward. And so I think this is the concern of not only NGOs that are advocating and that are working in the plastics treaty process, but also a very big concern among country delegates in terms of how they're going to make use of this revised zero draft going into INC4.
Yeah, I think you guys have your challenge ahead for sure. Well, why don't maybe we'll focus on one aspect of the draft. Maybe there's a part of the draft that is good, possibly. And maybe Arpita, you can help me with this one. I know that there's a fundamental theory of environmental law called the prevention principle, or sometimes called the precautionary principle, that was established in 1972 when the United Nations Environment Program was founded. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this prevention principle is already incorporated into several international environmental agreements, like the International Convention of the Prevention of Pollution from Ships, MARPOL, the United Nations Conventions and the Law of the Sea. So it's kind of a well-established concept that seems natural would be incorporated into the treaty. Is it in this revised zero draft? Have people been talking about it? Or have we lost focus on this prevention principle?
Well, if I have to give you a brief answer, we lost the focus on the prevention principle a long time back when we allowed plastic production to grow in the manner that it has, without sound science or knowledge of its impact. And after that, it has taken so long to really acknowledge and address the situation. Before going into INC3, submissions were made on the scope and principles, which in itself was coming from the countries that I would not like to name, but we are all aware of, and was an opportunity for them to kind of expand on the text. In theory, the mandate for this resolution 5/14, on which the entire treaty negotiations kind of are based, included this principle, right? And asked for a full life cycle, a comprehensive approach. And that is why we are at a critical juncture as we go into INC4 to kind of remind and sort of re-emphasize that the full life cycle actually begins with the extraction of fossil fuels. And if you go back to the zero draft or the revised zero draft, the mention of fossil fuels and the mention of extraction is the most minimum. I think some of us even sat and counted the number of times it's been mentioned. Fossil fuel is none, to be honest. And in terms of the revised zero draft, what is good is that everything is still there. I think one of the positives that we had after INC3 is that we still have everything. But that also means that we have to negotiate everything going into INC4.
Well, then I'm gonna ask Semi a question, which is that I know BFFP advocates apply this fundamental law of prevention across the entire life cycle of plastic, which is what we want, right? From product design to reuse repair models to extend the end life of plastic. But I think you guys call that zero waste hierarchy. And maybe you can talk about how going into the INC3 meetings, whether the zero draft included that, what's going on with this revised draft, and what are we going to do about that for INC4?
Right. So if you actually kind of go back in time when we first initially had the zero draft to work with during INC3, the word zero waste is actually not even mentioned in the zero draft at all. but now then, if you take a look at the revised zero draft, which will now be, you know, the document that we'll be working on during INC4, it's at least mentioned once. And
oh,
it's mentioned,
nice.
Yeah. And it's mentioned under information exchange. And I mean, I think everyone on this podcast with me, I think, believe that it should be mentioned more than once and more than, you know, not only to be confined under information exchange, but really just kind of be sprinkled throughout the entire zero draft.
Right. But
and so it's only mentioned once, encouraging parties to exchange studies and experiences on circular economy and zero waste initiatives. So are we going to consider that as progress, as a win? I'm not quite sure if that's good enough progress for us to celebrate.
I don't think
that.
So.
Exactly. No.
Then is part of the, you know, this challenge of, we all know that we have to get it to the source, right? We all know that you have to get it up to the production, but that starts to get to move into fossil fuel countries, fossil fuel companies, and it just makes it all much, has that made it more political? Has that made it more difficult in the meetings?
I think what one needs to remind that it's about 13 or 14 countries who are against sort of the production cuts. When we think of the actual facts, that means majority of your countries, upwards of 133, are in favor and recognize the need of reduction and cuts. The concern is that the other majority, the small minority, has a lot of economic power, investments, and influence in many of these multilateral spaces, and often get, therefore, the stage to be heard and the stage to dominate and kind of have the political will and the economic power to kind of strategize and push the negotiations. And these are also the folks who often come with industry prepared to strategically maneuver their way to prevent any kind of progressive discussions to happen. So we need to keep that in mind. So there's a lot of politics that is involved.
Magis, do you have a thought about the need to include plastic production limits and how that you've thought has influenced the politics of the treaty?
Yes, of course. Because, you know, we all know that plastics causing harm throughout its life cycle. Yeah, people and the environment are directly harmed from the hazardous emissions during the extraction, toxics released during the production of plastics, and also toxic exposures from the use and disposal of plastics. So what we are emphasizing is for it to be a successful treaty, yeah, to prevent harm to human health and the environment, it is critical to reduce plastics production, yeah, and also to prioritize elimination of plastics with toxic chemicals. So at the national level itself, we are also having national advocacy with the delegates, you know, to emphasize all these issues.
Yeah. And how did it, I know you were with the country of Malaysia at INC3. Did you feel as though, is it hard for countries to also espouse everything that the NGOs want them to espouse? Or how is that communication going?
We can see in terms of the National Coordinating Committee that was established by the Malaysian government. So you do have the NGOs and also the petrochemical industry, plastic manufacturers, plastic recycling. So the government has to balance out in terms of the issues that they are projecting. Yeah? So probably they might be talking about polymers of concern, but then in terms of reduction itself, so they say they are not in control of that, so it's not under their jurisdiction. So let's see what happens. But what we are trying to do as a civil society organization, we put forward our recommendations. We still keep doing that. And then there is also in terms at national level itself, they're listing down some of the single-use plastics that have to be eliminated. So we are working with the government and also other civil society organizations to push for this. Yeah, we don't wait for the Global Plastics Treaty. We are also doing our national advocacy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there are some exciting things, you know, that are happening in Asia. And you know, sometimes I wonder if, you know, there are a lot of frustrations right now with the Global Plastics Treaty, but even just the suggestion of it kind of puts countries on alert.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is coming down the pike, we hope. And maybe that's creating transformations. I don't know, Arpita or Simi, if you've seen that.
Yeah. I mean, just to give my experience, at least in the Asia Pacific. I think Magis has spoken that a lot of the Asian countries are kind of investing in Asia as the largest producer of plastics and packaging plastics, unfortunately. And we're also the largest receiver of plastic waste. But at the same time, we go with the economic argument of, you know, we need jobs and we need to our GDP and such things like that. Right. But what we have found interestingly, and especially this, I can say from the Southeast Asian context, the conversations with countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and so on, there is very much an interest in phasing out sort of what they call as the problematic chemical, the hazardous chemicals, because which is interesting for us, because the moment, you know, we might not get them to say production cuts, definitely, but the moment you try to kind of look at the criteria for phasing out problematic chemicals and toxics, which includes plastics, polymers, you have majority of the plastic used for packaging, single-use plastic, multi-layered plastic itself becoming redundant, itself becoming meaningless as it is. And so I think we try to find that common minimum and try to find that middle ground, which would be of interest to them, which would resonate with them, which would connect to their domestic interests, which would also connect to their political interests, because, you know, a lot of the countries in Asia are going into elections. The election season is on right now, which makes things all the more interesting. A lot of the countries actually change their delegates. You know, in some cases, it's bad for us. Like in the case of New Zealand, for example, we've moved back after the new sort of
more
government coming in my understanding.
Right.
Yeah. But in the case of Philippines, for example, we're looking forward to a more progressive delegate heading the delegation who is optimistic. So some of these delegates, I think I need to explain the politics a little bit in more nuance, is that some of these delegates, of course, are participating in these international forums, including the treaty, but may not necessarily have power to make things happen domestically, right?
If
you can leverage their position in these international forums to get them to commit to some progressive, legally binding measures, then we could also kind of leverage that to create ripple effect of sort of pushing more progressive policies nationally, whether it is the extended use of responsibility or it is the banning of single-use plastic. So those kind of changes are also happening that we need to keep track of and that we work with our members to kind of push for, which is why I said the treaty in itself is not necessarily the end goal.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe it. Semi, what do you think we're moving forward now to INC4? So then on the back of what Arpita is saying, which is that at least, you know, the concept of the treaty and the treaty negotiations and hopefully the delegate process even is creating influence in the countries in Asia. But if, as we move forward to INC4, then how can we harness some of that energy?
So far at the moment, I think it's much easier for us to identify the more relatively ambitious countries versus the ones who are kind of dragging their feet. But there are so many member states and so many countries that are kind of like in the middle ground where they're still quite unsure as to, you know, what this prospective instrument is going to look like and what the implications may be for their national legislations or for their domestic policies. And we really need countries to kind of, for lack of a better word, get on with the program a little bit and really kind of start picking things up, because, you know, as we currently stand with the schedule that's ahead of us, we're really running up against time here, and we really need countries to start figuring out where they want to be lining up in terms of their ambition, in terms of the future of this treaty. And we really hope that they decide to be on the right side of history, really, because this is really a historic moment for all of us.
And Magis, what I'm curious about is how you guys then try to engage the governments that you're working with and living in, and maybe how the public can help you do that.
Okay, Malaysia is not part of the High Ambition Coalition, and also they're not part of the other coalitions. What they have done from the beginning, they have been engaging civil society organizations during the consultations. In fact, they have also invited us in the Consumer Association of Penang for a one-to-one discussion with them right before the INC4. So we're going to put up our recommendations based on Gaia's analysis and also other analysis by the International Pollutants Elimination Network, yeah, besides our own analysis of the subject. We have also submitted our points of concern. And we are informed that all this will go through the cabinet before it is approved and for the national delegation to put up at the INC4.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. I think other than the formal processes, right, because some of the countries follow those formal processes with consultations, with sort of asking civil society, including the industry, for their submissions, etc. I think we really function, at least, you know, in my case, function as, you know, spies and investigators, I can't say a lot, but you know, there are a lot of strategies, and you know, because see, Mercy, to be honest, we don't have the kind of resources that the industry has, and you look at their presence, and you look at their engagement, and you look at their sort of being able to create so many platforms to kind of push their false narratives across. We don't have all of that. What we have is this momentous once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that Semi called out, that Inger Andersen, that so many different, you know, government agencies, bodies called out as the biggest opportunity for plastics, you know, after the Paris Agreement. And let's not go there, but there is so much intelligence that we are sitting with our members. So for me, you know, for us in Gaia, we see a lot of opportunities to kind of try to bring, for example, the ambitious countries together, to organize them, to get them to talk to each other, to get them to understand their perspective, to get them to really, you know, strengthen their organizing at INCs. And a lot of this work actually happens before we get to the INCs. Actually, majority of the work happens before we get to the INCs.
How does that, even though there are no intersessional meetings or anything like that, so then it's your own advocacy running out, going out there?
It's both. Actually, there are, that's why I said we have to work like spies. There are informal intersessional meetings happening on various issues. That are organized by certain governments. So it's important to get the right people, have the independent scientists who can kind of counter the false industry solutions, so to say. But also, there are the regional meetings. I mean, I must mention that we had the first opportunity ever to participate in the Asia-Pacific regional meeting, albeit it was, you know, very limited participation, very limited time, very limited space given to us. Out of the six speakers, five were from the industry, but we were able to make our statements and make a very bold statement calling for the participation of sort of the affected communities, the solutions of reuse, refill, and of course, production reduction. So we have these, we kind of try to get into these, you know, formal and informal opportunities, but also connect the dots with delegates we know are talking the same lines.
Well, thank you all for joining me today and giving me your thoughts, but more importantly, for just not giving up on this subject and not giving up on finally, I hope, one day ending this plastic pollution crisis in Asia. Your efforts are heard and greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Marcy. Bye.
Hey, Sustainable Asia listeners, I'm Marcy Trent Long, and this episode was produced by Carol Meng in Hong Kong. Thanks to our guests, Arpita Bhagat, Director, Global Plastics Program, Gaia Asia Pacific, based in India, Semi Ri, Global Plastics Advisor, BFFP, based in Korea, and Mageswari Sangaralingam, Honorary Treasurer, Sahabat Malam, Malaysia. Check out the show notes for links to reports and research from our guests and from BFFP. Alexander Mobison created the intro-outro music made by repurposed and recovered waste items. In our next episode, we look at the impact of plastic toxins on our health and how limitations on those toxins can be signed into a global plastics treaty.